Thank you very much, gentlemen. In the trip that my family and I just took out west, we decided to roll in some vacation time and spend some time visiting parts of the country that we'd not been to before. We drove out, and so there was a lot of driving, and we decided to make the most of it. We decided that we would go through the northern tier states that we had not been through before, parts of North Dakota and Montana, Idaho, Oregon, down the coastline that way. And going through that area, we started out sort of following the Lewis and Clark Trail up in North Dakota, following the Missouri River up that way, seeing the impressive falls of western Montana, the Little Falls, the Great Falls, and then through Idaho into Washington State. And in Spokane, we got to see the falls there from parts of the headwaters of the Columbia River, following that down along the border of Washington and Oregon. I always thought of that area being very lush because of all the rivers, but it's high desert country. And so you get past the rivers and it's pretty dry, it's pretty desolate. We paused coming down that Columbia River Gorge area. We paused at the Bonneville Dam, one of the notable dams. There are a series of dams and locks along the river to make it easier for the shipping traffic to go way up in the river. And most of those dams have fish ladders along the sides. Bonneville Dam actually has viewing windows, so you can go down and you can watch these fish trying to get upstream through these ladders. It was very interesting seeing that. Part of the valley is very sharp on one side as well. There was Crown Point Vista House on one of the areas where you could view out and see the whole river valley for miles and miles and miles. It was quite a view. To end in that area, we stopped and saw the amazingly tall Multnomah, I think is how you say it, falls, cascade twice. The rocks along that area, very impressive. We then went down through Portland, Oregon, down to the Pacific Ocean, south of that area, and then following Route 5 down through Northern California. It seemed like Mount Shasta never moved. We followed it for hours, it seemed like. It's such a tall mountain, you see it forever. We finally arrived at Camp High Sierra at the end of that week, after having seen just so many amazing waterfalls and small parks and various other natural wonders. And we had a great time at High Sierra. It was amazingly hot there, though. My brother said in his instructions to everybody, make sure you bring some warm clothing for the evenings because it can get very cool. And so everybody overpacked because nobody used their warm clothing. Even at night, it was really warm. But one of the highlights of the camp was for everyone to see the giant sequoias. They're only about, Kings Canyon National Park is only about a half an hour from where they have camp. And so one of the activities was to take all of the kids in a various dorm, they took them by dorms, and they would hike some of the trails and they would go see these impressive trees. I didn't get to go because I was busy during camp, and so we made a point as we left camp on Sunday that I wanted to go by and see these trees because I didn't know if we'd ever get back out that way. And as I mentioned, that's in Kings Canyon National Park. Specifically, we stopped and saw what's called General Grant's Grove. This is the second largest concentration of sequoias in the country. And the sequoia named General Grant is the second largest sequoia in the world. The sequoias are a truly magnificent part of God's creation. If you've never seen them, it's hard to describe them and do it justice. They're just so impressive and so amazingly large. But as I looked at those trees, I pondered a number of spiritual lessons, and that's what I'd like to share with you today. The title of my sermon is Lessons from the Sequoia. Before I get into the lessons, though, I'd like to give you some interesting facts regarding the sequoias. The sequoias are also called the Sierra Redwoods. They're related to what we commonly know as the redwoods, although they're different. Both are considered ancient conifers. The scientific name for the sequoia is Sequoia dendron gigantium, giant sequoia in Latin, and they truly are. They're huge trees. They can grow to a height of more than 300 feet tall. They can grow as much as 1 to 2 feet a year until they're about 200 to 300 feet high. And then at that point, like people, they grow out. not up anymore. So they get to that height and they just get wider. They have thick, spongy bark. It can be as much as 2.5 feet thick, which is pretty impressive on its own. The branches, and they once they get to that full height of 200 to 300 feet, they have no low branches. All the branches are mostly in the upper third. But those branches are still impressive. Many of them can be 8 feet in diameter, which is larger than most trees get, let alone branches. The average base of a sequoia is as much as 40 feet in diameter, and there are many that reach more than 100 feet in diameter. So if you can sort of picture the width of this seeding area, that's about how big some of them are. They're huge. The sequoias only grow naturally on the western slope of the Sierra Nevada mountain range, which is where that is, mostly between 5,000 and 7,000 feet of elevation, although because of their impressive nature, many parks like to have a sequoia, and many have planted them, and they grow all over the world. The oldest living sequoia is a tree named General Sherman. It's estimated to be more than 2,200 years old. That tree was 200 years old when Christ was born, and it's still around. It's estimated to weigh approximately 2.7 million pounds, and it has a height of more than 275 feet and a base diameter of more than 102 feet. The oldest known sequoia ceased to exist. I think it was cut down some years ago. The oldest known sequoia was more than 3,200 years old. When the loggers first went into the area, they couldn't quite figure out the geometry to estimate their height. And so to determine how tall they would cut them down. And then they would count the rings to figure out how old they were. Not much they can grow after that. The giant sequoia tree is the largest living thing on the planet. They can weigh more than 4,000 tons, which is 8 million pounds. And they can have a volume of 30,000 to 50,000 cubic feet in something we might recognize that's equivalent to about 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. That's the volume of that lumber and that tree. The giant sequoia is the largest tree measured in total volume. The redwoods are taller, although they're much thinner, and the bristlecone pines are much older, but there's no comparison. At any given time, a large sequoia can have more than 11,000 cones on its branches, with the potential of having more than 300,000 seeds in those cones. So let's look at some of the lessons. Point number one, lesson number one, fire is necessary for the sequoia to thrive. You might ask yourself how that can be. Most trees die when there's a fire. And for a long time, the various Forest Service departments would try to squelch fires in some of these parks. And while the sequoia is massive when fully grown, the cone it produces is really counterintuitive, if you will, to that size. The size of a cone for a sequoia is about the size of a chicken egg. Now, I've seen other conifers that have huge cones. In fact, one of the parks we stopped at in Northern California, I don't know what tree it came off of, but there was one pine cone that was about this big. It was huge. But a sequoia is very small, and that cone can hang on the tree for years, green, and it just stays there. Even when it falls to the ground, it remains unopened if it's still green. It has to dry out before it will open up, and that's where the fire comes in. The fire creates such heat in the forest that it dries that cone out. And if you've ever seen cones, then they open up. Before that, they're very tight and closed. The fire not only opens the cone so the seeds can germinate, the fire also plays another important role that I'll talk about in a moment. But I'd like for you to turn with me now to 1 Peter chapter 4. Bible has a lot to say about trials and how it describes them. And Peter does that as well here in 1 Peter 4 and verse 12, where he says, "Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing has happened to you." We do that oftentimes, don't we? When we come upon a trial, we seem to think that we're the only one that goes through these kind of things. Or we'll look around and we'll notice who's not going through a trial and say, well, why us and not them? Or any number of these sort of things that we'll go through. And Peter here is reminding us, look, don't think this is something odd or unusual. This is part of our calling. We'll talk more about that as we go through here, but this is something that we should embrace, really, as the Sequoia does. Now, when the National Park Service took over care of Kings Canyon Park, because prior to the federal government owning and running, if you will, that land, it was a state park, and before that it was private land, when the National Park Service took over the care, they worked hard to prevent forest fires. Their policy was that fire destroys, and so they were going to prevent this. Well, it was more than 90 years before they discovered they were actually working against the sequoia, because there were no new trees growing. They became very concerned about this, and they finally discovered what wasn't happening. Because the sequoia needs fire for the cone to open and for the seeds to germinate, there are very few new seedlings. It's possible that they can fall and there are various insects that will bore into those cones and open them up because they dry out then, but that's very rare and it's not the way it normally happens. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul talks about another aspect of our character, if you will, and what God seeks to have happen in the circumstances of life that we go through. And many times we look at those fiery trials as problems, but God looks at them as part of the process of what's necessary. In 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 13, Paul says here, now in the previous verse he was talking about refining of metals and how things would be revealed based on the building material. In verse 13 he says, then each one's work will become clear, that is, what it's made of. Each of our character will become clear when it's tested. He says, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort it is. Now, this is especially true of metals. And if you've ever seen that process, it doesn't even have to be a precious metal, it can just be steel. If you ever watched the process of steel being made, they superheat it until it becomes liquid. And when it becomes liquid, then the impurities separate out. They usually float to the top, and all they've got to do is skim it like you would cream off of fresh milk. And then what's left is the really good material. The material you can use, because if the contaminants stay in there, if the dirt and other material that's not the steel, the metal, the iron that you need, then that metal will be weak. It won't hold up to the stresses. And I find it interesting in the sequoias, they're unique in God's creation, that they need fire to be able to grow. Now, you remember I talked about that bark, 2.5 foot thick bark. That's part of how they can sustain and exist in those fires. Their character, if you will, is revealed. They're able to reproduce. Now, once that cone is opened, most of them are still on the tree, that volume of heat that is rising dries out those cones and opens them up. The seeds can fall to the ground and take root. I find it interesting as well that as small as the cone are, the seeds are even smaller. The average seed inside those cones is about the size of a typical grain of oat. It's flat, it looks just like a grain of oat. Luke 17 says something about small nature. God seems to like to use that at times to confound our wisdom. And when he starts with us, it's in a very small way, isn't it? Most of us, when we come into contact with God's truth, it's because of one point of doctrine or another, or it's a specific example of somebody that we respect or know, and it builds, doesn't it? One of the astounding things about God's way of life, as far as I'm concerned, is that it never gets old. There's always more to learn, to grow in, to change, to discover. In Luke 17, in verse 5, here the apostles are talking to Christ and they say, increase our faith. They at least recognize that even in their carnal state. And so then he responds and says, if you have faith as a mustard seed. Now we're switching analogies here from a sequoia to a mustard tree, which is an even smaller seed. But he says, if you have even that small of faith, you could say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and planted in the sea, and it would obey you. The small aspects of things God does not despise. And oftentimes, as I mentioned, he uses those small things to confound us. And I find it no small irony that the largest tree on the planet has such a small seed to begin with. The second point, second lesson, is that fire, also clears the underbrush so a newly germinated seed can grow. That is, once they are tried, then there is growth. In 1 Peter chapter 1, it's often the case with us. As I mentioned, many times we'll see our trials as punishment, when oftentimes what God is seeking to do is provide an opportunity for growth. Because on our own, we probably wouldn't be challenged in the same ways, would we? We'd be looking for the comfortable route, the easy route. In 1 Peter 1 and verse 7, breaking into the thought, Peter says that the genuineness of your faith being more precious than gold, that is, that small seed that we just read about of faith that God gives us, that God works with us in our calling, even that smallness is more precious than gold, God says, that perishes. You know, gold has great value because of its scarcity, but it's limited still, isn't it? You can't eat it. There's such a small volume, you can't build with it. You can't do a lot of things with it except use it as an exchange rate. And so it's limited. He says, even though it is tested by fire and may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, there is value in it, but it's limited. And he says, even in that limited value, compared to our faith is more precious than that. But it has to be tried with fire. Even that gold has to be refined. Now, I mentioned that bark on the tree, and it's like insulation that we wrap around our houses and put between our studs in our walls. That bark protects the sequoia from that tremendous heat, not only because it's thick, but that bark contains a number of different chemicals, and one of the primary chemicals is tannic acid. Tannic acid is a chemical that's also used in modern fire extinguishers. It's a retardant. And so this tree naturally has this retardant, this fire retardant built into it. Remember what we just read back in 1 Corinthians 3:13, that it will be revealed by fire. You can't consume what you want to reveal. And God provided for that in that sequoia. And you know what? He does the same for us. He doesn't seek to consume us in the refining process. We need to remember that. Revelation chapter 3, if you go back a little bit further towards the end of the book. Revelation 3 in verse 8, God says, verse 18. I counsel you to buy me gold refined in the fire. And I mentioned that refining process with metals. It's all the same in principle. You heat it up, you make it liquid, the impurities you can skim off. God says, I want that from you. I want you to be like gold refined in the fire, that you may be rich and with white garments, that you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve that you may see. Again, the fire clearing the underbrush for the sequoia provides an opportunity. God puts us through a refining process to provide opportunity so that we can be more precious than that, so that we can take on those white garments, and so that His character will be revealed in us. Since the sequoia can withstand fires that consume virtually any other tree, it's the only thing left standing after the fire is gone. Once you burn that underbrush, once you burn those fir trees and the various other undergrowth around the sequoias, all that's left are the sequoias. As a result, the ground around it is not only cleared, because sequoias need a tremendous amount of light and water to grow. You're not going to grow 300 feet in a crowded environment. Not only has the ground been cleared, but all of those trees and all of those bushes and all of the other material that's been burned up is now also fertilizer for those seeds. And also then can help hide the seed, if you will, until it germinates and takes root. Ephesians chapter 6. Oftentimes in the midst of trials, what God is doing is clearing the underbrush. He's clearing it out so that we can further grow. And while you're turning to Ephesians 6, I'll just mention this to you. If you ever have occasion to read the book of Acts and read it in terms of the cycles the church went through, growth and persecution, growth and persecution, I find that a very interesting cycle. Because every time they were persecuted, the church struggled. And when that persecution was done, then they grew. There was room to grow after God had refined them. Ephesians 6 and in verse 13, here Paul is talking about the armor, and again we're sort of mixing the metaphor, but I want you to especially take note of the last part here where he says, "Therefore take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day." And I don't think there's anybody here that would doubt that that means today. But notice what he says afterwards here, "And having done all," that is, having done all to withstand the evil, "then stand." We cannot give up. You do not get to be 2,200 years old by giving up. You don't get to inherit eternal life by giving up. You don't take on the nature of God by giving up. God wants us to stand. Now, those seeds from the sequoia can only grow successfully in soils full of the right minerals, full of sunlight, free from competing vegetation, and plenty of water, as I mentioned. Now, the sequoias grow, as I said earlier, at the 5,000 to 7,000 foot range, ideally, on the western slope. If you look at those mountains, and as the clouds come in off the Pacific picking up moisture, when they hit those clouds and they're pushed upwards, they condense. And as they condense, that water becomes heavier, and so it rains more on the western slope. At that elevation as well, they're not down in the hot valleys. And it's not so high that that area is completely covered in harsh snows over the winters. And so they're in a very temperate, for sequoias, they're in a very temperate zone. And they thrive. What's also interesting about sequoias is with that fire, they're not immune from it completely. They can be scarred. In fact, many of the sequoias that we saw, you could see, and these scars would go up 30, 40, 50 feet or more in some of these trees, huge black sections. I mean, it wasn't just that the fire didn't even touch them. It would scorch huge parts of this tree. But I mentioned the chemicals in the bark. One of the other chemicals is a chemical that helps the bark heal. It restores the bark. Hebrews chapter 11. God restores us, doesn't He? We read through many of those other verses that talked about fiery trials. That God allows us to go through those trials to be purified, to be refined. But there's a caution that we don't let the fire get to us as well. In Hebrews 11 and verse 34, here it says, speaking of those faithful who quench the violence of fire, you and I have within us, because of God's Spirit dwelling in us, the ability to quench many of those fires. Escape the edge of the sword. Out of weakness we're made strong. You know, not only when that fire clears the underbrush does that provide an opportunity, the environment, if you will, for its seedlings to grow, now there's less competition also for the established sequoias. They have access to more water and more sunlight as well. And so they grow as well. They continue growing. In fact, these large sequoias that are 200 or more years old, when they get to that full height, as I mentioned, they stop growing up and they grow out. Well, what they're doing growing out is adding girth to their branches. Some of those branches are more than 8 feet thick. I can't imagine a branch that big because I don't even know many trees that big. But it's astounding to see they come out the side and then they go up and they're huge. And standing from the ground, you can't even see the complete tops of these trees. They're obscured from view. God says we can quench those fires. And as I mentioned, the tannic acid in the bark that helps retard those flames. Lesson number three. I find this one very funny. The sequoias don't die of old age. They die of falling down. We don't think a tree that large has much problem standing up. But the sequoia is so pest resistant and fire resistant that the most common reason that they die is they fall down. Now, if you've ever had a piece of plywood or something flat or anything large, really, on a windy day, you know how little surface area it takes to really capture the wind and how hard it can pull at you, even a car door on a windy day. Well, think of something 200 feet tall with the volumes that we've talked about. That's going to capture a lot of wind. So how do they fall down? The roots of the sequoia go anywhere from about 6 to 20 feet deep for a 200, 300 foot tree. But what they do to compensate for this is that their roots go out and cover hundreds of feet out from the tree. The roots go out, not down. Now, even that alone wouldn't help hold it up. Pine trees, many pine trees do a similar thing. The key is that sequoias typically don't grow alone. They grow in groves, which is why the one is called General Grant's Grove, because there are dozens and dozens of these trees. And so they interlock root systems. And so as this one tree, if it catches wind and it becomes a sail, if you will, and the wind is pushing at it hard, as those roots are pulled, there are other roots holding it down. And so they don't stand alone. Luke 22. We often think of ourselves as alone in the world, and perhaps especially in this day and age because we're so scattered. But you and I are not supposed to operate as Christians in that environment. We are not supposed to be alone. We're called to worship as a family every week, aren't we? We're called to operate together, to care for one another. And this is part of what Christ talks about here in Luke 22 and verse 32. He says, "But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail." That faith that we read about earlier, that's this teeny tiny little seed, more precious than gold. God says, Christ, "I want that to succeed." And he said, even beyond that, when you have returned to me, that is when you come back to me in terms of your dependence and your growth and your character, when you've done that, then strengthen your brethren. Because see, if we're in it just for ourselves, then we're missing a major component of our calling. Because we won't be acting independently in the future. We'll be part of a family. The sequoias do that. I find that a very interesting analogy here. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, as Paul gave instruction to Timothy, he touched on a point I'd like to highlight as well now. 1 Timothy chapter 6, and in verse 19, where he says, basic instructions here as he closes this first letter, and he's talking about rich individuals. He said, "Storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." You know, what do our roots hold on to? You know, I mentioned gold earlier, and that's probably one of the hottest commodities right now in this economy. The buying and selling of gold. People have so little trust anymore in our paper currency. They have so little confidence in government policy or even the future in general. They want something tangible, but we know that's not going to be sufficient. Because like I said, you can't eat that. When it comes down to, you know, you starving and having gold, what good is it going to do you? There has to be a better foundation. For that sequoia, 20 feet is not good enough, is it? Even for many smaller trees, 20 feet is not good enough. In a very strong wind, it's still going to get pushed over. And to think of those trees living for thousands of years, and to look at them, they don't look like they're interdependent. Because there's one here, and then several hundred yards, there's another one. There might be a few small ones in between. And they look independent, but they're not. They're very dependent upon each other. Galatians chapter 6, we're reminded of this, where Paul talks about our calling. Galatians 6, verse 2, where he says, "Bear one another's burdens." Now, we can't solve those issues, if you will, for each other, can we? That's for us to work out. We each work out our own salvation, but it is also our responsibility to help each other work out their salvation. And part of it, as we read here, is to bear one another's burdens. And in doing so, he says, fulfill the law of Christ. We intertwine our roots so that we don't fall down. We can stand like the sequoias. Lesson number 4. Sequoias can die from fire. They're superbly designed to withstand the most ravaging forest fires, but they can die from fire if the fire gets through their protective bark. And there are a couple of ways that can happen. I mentioned their unique fire-resistant properties in the bark earlier, but if there's an opening in that bark, if the fire is too close to the roots, if the ground has eroded and exposed some of the roots, the fire can get inside. But even then, they're not destroyed like normal trees are. And once the fire gets past the bark, there's nothing to stop it. But it doesn't get fed like normal fire. Fire needs a lot of oxygen. But you can burn something with very little oxygen. I used to do this with the wood stove when I was growing up. You'd bank it at night, and you'd turn down the oxygen until there's almost nothing getting in the stove. And it would smolder all night long. It would slow burn. And that's what can happen to a sequoia. When the first explorers to the area first saw these trees, they couldn't believe the size either. There was nothing like this they'd ever seen or known about. And in fact, one year, some of the loggers cut a cross-section of one of the largest trees, and they sent it back east to one of the world's fairs or things of this nature. The people that viewed it thought it was a hoax. They thought they had taken different parts of trees and put it together to make this huge circumference, because they couldn't believe themselves either that there was something this huge. But these first explorers also found many massive trunks on the ground. Remember I mentioned they fall over? They don't die of old age, they fall over. Well, because of the properties in them, those chemicals that resist fire and resist bugs, when they lay on the ground, they'll lay there for hundreds and hundreds of years before they decompose, because there's very little that will eat on it. What happens, though, when the fire gets inside is that it will burn the inside of the tree. It makes a tube. And so you can still see these lying on the ground in these parks. And because of their size, many of these early explorers, they used them for shelter or for storage. In fact, the cavalry was one of the first groups tasked with protecting this area, and they stabled their horses in these trees. We walked through one of them. You don't have to bend over. You can just walk through it. The inside of this one was between two paths, and it was okay to go through it, and you see this black inside. Roxanne, I did too, thought that it was old and dried, and she put her hand up, and her hand was covered in soot, just wiping the end of it. It was still there. James chapter 3, verse 5. There's an analogy James is talking about, again, to sort of mix the metaphors here. He's talking about the tongue, but he brings in the aspect of fire as well. James 3, verse 5, he says, "The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell." I'm sorry, that was verse 6. Verse 5 is, "See how great a forest a little fire kindles." I talked about the National Park Service recognizing that the sequoia needs fire to have its seeds germinate, for those cones to open and be able to germinate. Well, they still don't trust nature completely, and so they'll do controlled burns. You know, they'll start a fire in an area that hasn't burned for a number of decades to try to clear out some of the growth, allow the possibility of these cones germinating, these seeds in the cones rather germinating. But oftentimes it can still get under the bark, like I mentioned, exposed roots or some of these areas. Because even though this area has a lot of moisture, they have their dry seasons. And when you light tinder, you know what happens. Even if you want to control it, there's oftentimes no control in that. And even if they know that it gets inside the tree, there's not much they can do about it. James here cautions us as well. We need to be careful with the fire. Even though those fiery trials are around us, we need to be careful we're not the ones setting the fires, that we're not the ones harming each other or creating the possibility that this will get inside someone and slowly consume them. Because you and I have seen that over the years. I've seen too many individuals, well, they'll just chew on something, they'll chew on something for decades in some cases, and they'll finally leave the church because it's unresolved in their mind. That slow burn of the fire consumed them. Ephesians chapter 6, again, Paul used this analogy in the armor. But in verse 16, he says, above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. If we don't take care of that bark, like the sequoia, if that bark is damaged, then those darts can get through. Second Corinthians 4 and verse 16. One of the other aspects, as I mentioned, of the sequoia is their age. And it was really impressive, especially to Anson, to consider that these trees, many of these trees, started growing hundreds of years before Christ was born. And they're still here. 2 Corinthians 4, and in verse 16, he says, therefore, we do not lose heart, even though the outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. When you look at something that has existed for thousands of years, it puts in perspective our short lifespan. We don't think in terms of thousands of years. We think in terms of, what, 5, 6, 7 decades, maybe 100 years. And so we view everything through that lens, don't we? We think everything has to happen within that short time span. God is reminding us that it's not the case. We're not to lose heart because some things take time. And as we read here in verse 16, even though we're outwardly perishing, we grow old and all kinds of things happen, most of them not good. Yet inwardly, we're supposed to be renewed day by day. I mentioned the bark on that tree that helps to restore its health. We have access to God's Spirit that even if we come through a trial damaged, that we can be restored. God's Spirit working in us, the support of one another that I mentioned earlier. Notice verse 17, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment. You know, if we could speak for the sequoias, they would probably view the fire as just some minor inconvenience because they're so able to withstand it. You and I should get to a point where we're less and less troubled by the trials we go through and more concerned with what it is God wants us to see. I think that's a perspective that only comes with age, spiritual age. Verse 18, for while we do not look at the things which are seen, but which the things that are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporary. You know, in spite of their impressive age, they too die. They pass away. So do we. He says, but rather the things which are not seen are eternal. The lessons that we can draw from something like a sequoia tree, those spiritual things that we should learn from what God is teaching us, even in the world around us, are what are eternal. I'd like to leave you with one last thought in Proverbs 25. This is one of my favorite verses, because I see it as a challenge from God. You know, it's impressive to spend, as we did, time viewing God's creation. We spent time in Yosemite, and we saw Yosemite Falls. There's the upper, the middle, the lower, and I forget how many hundreds, if not thousands of feet those falls cover. And you look at the volume of water coming over those falls, the power behind that. And as I mentioned to one other individual, you know, to me it's just astounding the mechanics involved in water. Why doesn't the snow melt all at once? The temperature is there. It should, but it doesn't. Even when it goes in the ground, how does some of it stay and some of it release? And why does it release over the course of a whole year? Why doesn't it just give way and it's all gone at once? You know, when you consider all of those things, and in Proverbs 25, verse 2, Solomon here writes, "It is the glory of God to conceal a matter." And I'm constantly amazed when I watch nature shows or science programs, and they're discussing something about the creation around us, and the complexity and the details, and all that they understand and all that they don't understand, and how they then dismiss God in any of this. They skip right past the fact that some intelligence has to be behind this. And they worship the creation rather than the Creator. And yet there is God, as it says there in verse 2, God concealed in plain sight. He hid in plain view the evidence of His existence. And if we would stop to consider these things, then also the responsibility of what He wants from us. Notice the end of verse 2, "But it is the glory of kings to search out a matter." God wants us to understand His creation, but more importantly, He wants us to understand why He did these things and what it is that He has in store for us, to search out those matters and to pursue them. It was truly inspiring for me to stand in the presence of those massive sequoias. And we have no way to appreciate those sizes because we're not around that on a regular basis. But I'm also impressed by God's creative abilities, and I'm even more impressed by His execution of those abilities. The complexity and the variety of the creation around us is truly astounding. As we ponder God's creation, let's remember the spiritual lessons that we can draw from that creation. And today, as I leave you, I encourage you to remember the lessons from the sequoia.